Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
I am ready. All right, born ready.
Born ready, yo. There we go.
Hello, I am Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us, or so we like to say.
And believe, in point of fact. Anyway, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Tuesday, single topic today, the topic of which is FEC, the Federal Election Commission, versus Ted Cruz for Senate. It's a case that we touched on last week, and it's about the Supreme Court and campaign finance, and now where do things go? That's what we're going to talk about.
Right. The Supreme Court sided with Republican Senator Ted Cruz and basically said that a cap on using contributions that come in after Election Day to pay off personal loans candidates made to their campaign is unconstitutional. That cap is not okay on First Amendment grounds. So previously, if a candidate lent their own campaign money, they could only get up to a certain amount of that back. And now that limit doesn't exist. And so we want to know what this means for the midterms, the future of campaign finance, and where the Supreme Court may be headed next in its interpretation of the First Amendment.
Daniel Wiener is here to make us smart. He is, first of all, he's back. He's been with us before. He's also the director of the Brennan Center's Elections and Government Program at NYU, New York University. Did you go to commencement, by the way? Did you see Taylor Swift in Yankee Stadium?
You know, I didn't. Oh, okay. I missed that.
My niece was there. She said it was great. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about.
I know nothing of this.
She gave the commencement address and NYU graduates in
Yankee
Stadium.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, back to Ted Cruz. So what did Senator Cruz say in front of the Supreme Court that got the justices to see things his way?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And I'm sorry I can't offer commentary on Taylor Swift,
right.
Although I'm a fan, actually. But we'll move on to Senator Cruz. I think the best way to understand this decision is it's one in a series of decisions that the Supreme Court has issued that kind of have dismantled various aspects of our campaign finance regulation system. And what Senator Cruz and his lawyers argued here was in keeping with arguments that others have made before, which was essentially that, look, money, spending money is equivalent to speech for First Amendment purposes. This rule that, limits my ability to recoup, money that I spent to pay for speech indirectly inhibits my ability to speak. That is offensive to the First Amendment. Therefore, I win. He I think, expected a receptive audience, and he got it.
So you all over at the Brennan Center filed an amicus brief supporting the provision of the law that the court struck down. Why did you all think it was important?
Well, I think that, look, this is probably not the most famous provision in the campaign finance code. One might even say it was maybe a bit obscure. That's always the case here. But if you actually look at the facts on the ground, there's actually, no evidence that this inhibited any speech or very little evidence. Most candidates do not loan their campaigns money. The majority of those who do tend to loan themselves less than the $250,000 cap. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that the regulation, you know, really played very little role in actually how even the candidates who did loan themselves substantial amounts of money decided to spend that money. So traditionally, when the court has looked at fundraising limits of this sort, it has, you know, done that kind of practical analysis of, you know, is anyone actually prevented from speaking here? And it, you know, and generally has come to the conclusion that these sorts of, you know, contribution limits don't limit people from speaking. And we thought it was important to vindicate that point. So we came in, we provided some statistics showing that there really was a very limited impact on speech. You know, unfortunately, that didn't win the day, but we thought it was an important principle to vindicate.
So look, here's the completely jaded question. But as long as the Supreme Court equates money and speech, Katie, bar the door, right?
You know, it's hard. So here's the thing. There is undoubtedly an important connection between the ability to spend money and the ability to speak. I mean, you spent money to create this radio program that you spent money on speech. So we don't dispute that. But the question is, you know, should there be reasonable limits, particularly in the electoral context? And even after Citizens United, even after some of these harmful decisions, the court has consistently said, you know, to prevent corruption, it is okay to limit your ability to raise money for electoral speech. And what we have seen, starting with Citizens United, but then increasing and you know, continuing in this decision as the latest example, is the court chipping away at the sort of structure of reasonable justifications for limits on electoral fundraising. And this is kind of another chink in the wall. I mean, it should be noted they didn't go as far as some people wanted. Senator Mitch McConnell basically came in and said, you know what, game over. You should just sweep away basically everything that's left of campaign finance law. They didn't go there. So that, you know, there's still some rules left. But the money and speech equation, while it's problematic, you know, there is some truth to that. But what's really concerning is that there's no consideration given to the other interests that may justify reasonable limits.
Right.
So walk me through how people are concerned this law is going to be interpreted, or this change or this update is going to be interpreted moving forward.
Well, I think that you have to take a look at this decision in a bigger context, right? So the immediate effect of this decision, I think, will be relatively limited. You might have a couple more rich dudes who can, you know, try to claw back some of the money they spent on their own campaigns. And it certainly doesn't help if you are concerned about the fact that running for office is, you know, increasingly the province of people who either are themselves very wealthy or at least have very wealthy networks. So that's not great. But if you look at it, again, it's another decision in a series that has kind of chipped away at decades-old safeguards that have, you know, limited the corrupting influence, what people call the corrupting influence of money in politics. And then if you zoom out even farther, you contrast that with the court's apparent lack of interest in protecting other First Amendment rights, including the right to vote. I think a fascinating comparison, there was a decision decided recently, it was called Brnovich v. DNC, about the right to vote. And the court literally used the mirror image of the reasoning in Cruz. The court said, well, yeah, you know, an Arizona law that restricted voting rights, it wasn't that big a restriction. And, you know, some sort of reasonable burdens, even if, frankly, they're more burdensome to communities of color, that's okay because nobody's perfect. So it literally batted that away, upheld the rule. Here, you have a very minimal, you know, restriction on the right of rich people to fund their own campaigns and then claw the money back. And the court was like, no, that's a violation of fundamental speech rights. So what you really have is you have a court that is simultaneously doesn't seem interested or is not as interested perhaps in protecting the First Amendment rights of ordinary people. And, you know, which the right to vote, you know, people don't always realize, but it is ultimately it's an act of political self-expression and association. It is protected by the First Amendment. You have a court that's less interested in protecting that and seems to be more interested in safeguarding the prerogatives of folks who already have a lot of power.
Okay, so look, following on that then, how much do you, and I'll let you sidestep this one if you want with maybe a follow-up or two, how much do you think the current political makeup of the court and then the politicization of that court in to be clear, other case law areas, right, of which we are all aware, how much does that affect their First Amendment rulings, do you think?
I would never sidestep a question from you. I how could you even think I would do that? Look, you know, I think that everyone tends to oversimplify the situation with the court, that the court is not a strictly partisan institution, but it has become dominated by a particular ideology that certainly one party subscribes to more than the other. And, you know, what do you call that? Originalism? You call it textualism, but a very, very, very ideologically charged view of the law. And you saw that in Citizens United in a 5-4 decision that swept away, you know, post-Watergate safeguards that had been in place for decades. You see that in the voting cases. So it's clear that there's a particular ideology that is ascendant right now. And it's not necessarily a consistent ideology because there's nothing particularly originalist about the campaign finance cases, but it is one that certain, you know, parts of the governing elite have worked very hard to put in place, and now you're seeing it come to fruition.
So where do we go then from here, right? In the next, I don't know, 5-10 years? What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on these sorts of questions pertaining to our democracy, I think the one silver bullet here, and I've said this to you before, and I know you're skeptical, but is that even this court, which is, you know, not committed to many of the values that certainly the Brennan Center has espoused, has been actually very adamant that Congress does have the power to make rules for elections, and it has the power to protect the right to vote. It also, frankly, has the power to shore up our campaign finance system.
But they tried right? I think it was McConnell versus FEC, right? I mean, Mitch McConnell went to court and said, no, McCain-Feingold, forget it.
Yeah, but the point, though, is that if you're concerned about why are we concerned about money in politics? We're concerned about money in politics because money acts as a barrier to entry. So, for instance, one reform that was in the democracy reform package that I know did not pass in this Congress was a program to match small contributions with public funds. And you have that in LA, for instance, and you have that in LA city elections. You have that in many other states and localities. That is a good way, for instance, to balance out the result in the Cruz case, and it's perfectly constitutional. And even this court, I think, would hold that it was constitutional. So I know you might disagree, but I think the future is going to lie ultimately in the elected branches of government, affirmatively taking steps to shore up our democracy.
But that's not, you know. Barriers to entry is not the only reason people worry about money in politics. It's also this pay-to-play idea. So if you've given yourself a $500,000 loan to your campaign and now you have all this time and the ability, once you were in office, to pay that off with donations to your campaign, that feels like it opens the door even wider for corruption than is already gate.
I think that, you know, what we need to do is we need to look at shoring up the rules that are still on the books that the court has not struck down, and actually, frankly, shoring up their enforcement. You know, one of the parties in this case, the Federal Election Commission, part of the problem is that, there are still direct contribution limits on the books. So actually critical to the court's reasoning was that, well, look, people can't give Ted Cruz $1 million after the election. They can write him a check for $2,800.
But a super PAC can.
The super PAC can.
Well, and the problem small is favors,
the super PAC, and the problem is, well, the super PAC can't donate directly to him, but they can spend money in his race. And the problem is the super PAC can also coordinate with his campaign. So what the FEC could do is it could do a better job enforcing those direct contribution limits. But right now, the FEC, evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, doesn't have a very strong enforcement record. So that's one thing. You could try to get the enforcer, the cop on the beat, to be more forceful about actually enforcing the rules we have.
Daniel Wiener, He's a director of the Brennan Center's Elections and Government Program there at NYU. Daniel, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting topic, the whole money and finance. I mean, it's infuriating and it's in many ways outrageous and all of that, but it's so interesting.
Every single election cycle, I'm doing stories about record-breaking amount of money spent in such and such race, the most expensive Senate race ever, the most expensive presidential election ever. And every time I think about it, I just like, there are so many things that we could be doing with these billions and billions of dollars. Yeah. And like, ugh. Also, Katie by the door?
Katie bar the door. Katie bar the
Katie
door.
Katie bar the door.
Katie bar
what?
The door. It means trouble's coming. Look out. Yes, trouble is coming.
I have never heard this phrase before. Katie bar the door. Who is Katie?
It doesn't matter. it doesn't matter.
It's like, it reminds me of Game of Thrones. Like, I immediately have a vision of Hodor, you know, like, hold the door, Hodor. Hodor, oh, wait, that was Hodor. A spoiler. Sorry.
Oh, come on. The series is 10 years old. All right, we're going. Let us know what you thought about that, about, you know, random sayings from the past. What surprised you about campaign finance? Anything. Our number is 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART is another way to dial that. Or you can send us a voice memo at makesmesmart@marketplace.org. We are coming right back.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
News and time for it. Ms. Adams, you go first.
I'm just still stuck on Katie by the door because like
Katie is standing by the door when she bars it, but the expression is Katie bar the door.
Katie bar. It's like I have a pretty deep well of like idioms
you're from St. Louis,
things.
Stuff there,
I know,
right? Come on.
and you sent me this link, and it says that it's, you know, usually heard in the southern United States, and you know, St. Louis is basically like quasi-southern, and I have to ask my mother about this and my grandma and see if they've ever.
Oh, let me know. Actually,
okay.
I'd be curious.
Yeah. Okay. Also, speaking of my youth, I spent like 15 years from preschool until I graduated high school at a Southern Baptist school.
Oh, wow.
Evangelical, very conservative, and all sorts of things.
So this news resonates. That's interesting.
This news really resonates. So there's this huge report that has been issued about sexual abuse in the Southern Baptist Church. And basically, after some Houston Chronicle investigations and other allegations came to light in the last couple of years, the Southern Baptist Convention basically commissioned its own investigation, right? And they gave this group called Guidepost Solutions a ton of access to documents, to people, and they revealed, this report is now out, and it turns out the Southern Baptist Convention, which is different from the independent churches, I should say that very specifically. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of like in a committee that loosely exerts influence, but it's a weird structure. But anyway, the leadership structure basically had a list of more than 700 abusive pastors, and they just didn't tell anybody. And they also, in some cases, you know, basically blame the survivors, embarrassed them, tried to shut them down, accused them of like trying to harm the ministry, and they actively blocked people who were, you know, reporting child molestation, sexual assaults, sometimes even from the leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention. And this is not a small group of people that we're talking about. This is one of the largest religious denominations in the country. I'm trying to find a number. I think it's something like 17 million people within this, but I'm gonna find that. But anyway, mm-hmm. there's a couple of links to it. But this is a huge denomination. This is a 300-page report. Christianity Today has a really great write-up of it. And it is, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention has really been trying to avoid comparisons to what happened in the Catholic Church. But at this point, it's even, you know, some of the leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention are like, you know, we expected it to be bad, but this is even worse than we thought. And it's pretty significant. And, oh yeah, here we go. It's a 13.7 million member denomination. Yeah. And so some of the group that came up with this report wants them to create an online database of abusers, offer compensation for survivors, sharply limit non-disclosure agreements, yeah. and establish a new entity dedicated to responding to abuse. This is from the Christianity Today article. And they've got a meeting. The Southern Baptist Convention has a meeting coming up, I think, next month, and they're going to have to sort out what to do about it. And this is going to be a real reckoning.
I would also be interested to hear what your mother and your grandmother had to say about this.
Well, oddly enough, they're not Southern Baptist.
Oh, okay then.
I was raised a missionary Baptist.
Gotcha.
It's different.
Totally.
Just went to a Southern Baptist school.
Totally. But it's, yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big
Our music was better at church.
Yeah. All right. My news item is very pedestrianated, total gear change, but it fits under the category of, and I think I've used this once or twice the past couple of weeks, this is what is supposed to be happening. When Jay Powell tightens interest rates and financial conditions tighten, a lot of things are supposed to happen and have been happening, right? First-time claims for unemployment benefits are up. The stock market is getting tighter. We all know those things. Here's another thing that is supposed to be happening. Sales of newly built homes down 16% in April. Now, prices went up, right, because supply has been reduced a little bit because of some inventory challenges. But the nut graph here is this. What we're talking about with this number that came out today is signed contracts for new homes. So it's really up to date. And it is down 16% in April, right? Slowest rate since the start of the pandemic. And why is this happening? This is happening because the monthly nut that people have to pay, right, which is the mortgage payment plus interest, part of which is interest rate based, plus insurance, by the way, is getting bigger. And so home sales are falling. And this is what's supposed to be happening. And I just want everybody to remember that things are supposed to be happening that are happening. And that's it. That's what I got.
Cold comfort to people.
It's horribly cold comfort. No, look, I totally get it. I totally get it. And look, I asked Jay Powell about this when I had him in front of me. I was like, what do you say to the people who are going to lose jobs because you are doing this? And, you know, he gave some very bureaucratic answer. But this is what is supposed to be happening. And we all just need to remember that. Now, whether he can do a soft landing, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Don't know.
Yeah. It's just there's no housing, you know, like every story Amy Scott does is like there's such a shortage. And now, you know, it's even more expensive to get get what homes are available. And I just, you know,
well, the whole affordable housing thing is a misnomer in this economy. But that's an entirely different podcast. Actually, Bridget, write that down. Affordable housing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're doing a housing thing with Amy, but this might be a separate one.
Still, we can't really talk about it enough. So,
right. Let's do the mailbag, Jake. Let us proceed.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
A lot of things. We asked y'all last week to share your ideas for what to say when you meet somebody in person you don't actually have any recollection of meeting on Zoom. Couple of you called in with some pretty clever suggestions. Here you go.
Hey, make me smart. This is Daniel from Birmingham, and I would like to submit for your consideration Deja Zoom.
The word for meeting that person that you've only seen on Zoom, Deja Nu. You can spell it however you like. Maybe Deja with an N-U.
And I'd call it Zoomnesia. It's what happens to me when I zone out.
My suggestion would be go back to meetings in your calendar to see the list of people that were included.
Very practical. Huh? Very practical.
But how do you associate the face to the name? Yeah. Well, I guess the people's names are on the thing, Zoom. Yeah. No, but you're not going to remember because the little tiles and people don't. Anyway, I like Deja Zoom. Sorry, yeah. I just went down the whole that one too. Like thread.
I'll go with that one too. Deja Zoom it is. Perfect.
All right. Thanks also to Jeff in Pasadena, Jim in Oakland, and Kelly in Akron, Ohio, for those submissions. And yeah, we also got this voice memo after we talked about the really cool Make Me Smart fan art. As I had to clarify to you, Kara Kai, the listener, Audie Norman, created.
Hi, Make Me Smart. My name is Katie, and I live in Northern Virginia. And I wanted to let you know that Kimberly is correct. Greaves are for legs, and for arms, they're called VAM braces. And the reason I know this is because I worked in a lot of Shakespeare theaters. Keep making us smart.
Wow. That's wild.
The reason I know that is because I played a lot of RuneScape when I was little. Younger. I wasn't that little. I was like in college. feels a little at this point. Yeah. I played a lot of RuneScape, and that was like some of the gear that you could get from all sorts of things and mining and converting and all that stuff.
I had no idea what they were called. All right. One more voice memo. This about the bear spray conversation we had, I think it was yesterday.
Hi, this is Sarah from Columbus, Ohio. Just wanted to share a quick note on Kai's Make Me Smile from Monday. The reason it's really important to remember that bear spray is not like bug spray is it's actually a specialized long-range pepper spray. So, yeah.
News you can use. News you can use. Point that bear spray can away from you.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would burn. Okay, before we go, we're going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about?
Hi, this is Paul calling from Vancouver, British Columbia. Something that I thought I knew that I later turned out to be wrong about is lifetime warranties. For more than 2/3 of my life, I thought that a lifetime warranty covered my lifetime. It doesn't. Mm. It covers the lifetime of the item that I bought. Oh. And I kind of wish that more people knew about that so that people in customer service jobs would have a much easier time when having to deal with warranty claims.
Absolutely.
But like
you object?
But the lifetime of the product is effective. Like, how do you know what the lifetime of the product is? If it breaks 5 years in, they can be like, oh, the lifetime was only 5 years, so your lifetime warranty doesn't apply. And you're like, but if you fixed it, it would last for 10. And so, like, I don't know. Okay.
I see what you're saying. I get it.
All right. Keep sending us your answers to the Make Me Smart question via voice memo to our email at makemesmart.org, which is where, you know, you record in advance and then send it, as opposed to calling us and leaving a message, which is different, at 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program was engineered by Jake Cherry with mixing by Gary O'Keefe. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
Because somebody's got to be in charge.
I cannot tell you.
What?
All the ways that Jasper has notified me he's less than pleased about my time away in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a purse that probably won't recover.
Oh, that's so funny when pets do that. You're like, man, just be mellow, will you? Just be mellow.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.